Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
December 11th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Time Magazine chooses its Person of the Year today. By now, you probably know Pope Francis won out over Miley Cyrus, but the selection process was a bit different this year than we've seen in years past. Some are saying it could be a shoe-in for a Pulitzer Prize this spring, a New York Times story about homelessness in the city, but it was published first on the Las Vegas Sun's website. We'll talk about how the paper managed to scoop itself. And with the one-year anniversary of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary coming up this weekend, we'll talk about what we've seen so far in the coverage. There's a lot more, hopefully, we'll get to as well, but I'd like to start with a story that's a little bit closer to home, like on Elm Street here in downtown Columbia. Monday, E.W. Scripps announced it had acquired Newsy for $35 million. The digital video news platform delivers content to AOL, Huffington Post, and Mashable, among others, in addition to its own award-winning mobile and tablet apps.
We believe in quality over quantity with a human editorial touch.
Our team members are multi-talented. One person alone may be able to write, edit video, serve as on-air talent, and specialize in building custom motion graphics.
Newsy's scalable online and mobile video news model has room to grow.
And the talent to fulfill the ever-increasing demand for internet and mobile video news content.
We're fast, flexible, and economically viable.
Economically viable, bringing in $35 million. What made this product so attractive to Scripps?
Well, I think Scripps in particular is interested because they're looking for a way to leverage video in a cost-effective way. They own a bunch of newspapers. They own a bunch of television stations in addition to some digital products. And so this is a way to get some high-quality video from a brand that's recognized out onto their websites at a time when video is clearly very popular and advertising tends to gravitate toward video at rates that are higher than other online advertising.
Yeah, I think it's one of these situations where you have an established company in Scripps that's looking for an opportunity to actually move its brand a little bit further out, and going toward video is the way to go.
You know, of course, the other thing about Newsy, I mean, just as its standalone company, one of the things that made it work in the first place was the fact that costs could be kept under control by locating it in Columbia, Missouri, where rents are not all that high, and right next to a school of journalism where a lot of free or inexpensive talent could be acquired to produce a lot of the videos that they ship out to all those other clients that you mentioned.
Go ahead, Ernest.
No, they were, and the fact that they're able to basically bring that in, bring that news in, work with students, work with young talent, and produce it in a way that's going to sort of branch out Scripps' demographic. So they'll be able to reach a lot more people in a lot different demographics than they normally have been able to do.
Newsy's been here in operation since 2008. What is it about now? What was the sweet spot that now was the time to make the move?
I haven't talked with Jim Spencer, who started Newsy, who's the CEO, who's a former student here at the university. But I would say that he's been building it up slowly but surely with very minimal investment. He's been keeping the cost under control while he's picked up all of these brand name clients you mentioned, like Mashable, AOL, Huffington Post. There are others that are in the works. And so I think probably it was a time when the company had proved its value, first of all, but also it's important because the acquiring company needed something like this. And they've talked about expanding Newsy's formula, maybe using the Newsy team to create more local content for their television station. So the timing was right on both sides.
I mean, Scripps had tried to do this on their own several years ago, and it just didn't work out. They weren't able to actually make it cost effective. So for them to be able to to come in and buy an operation like Newsy that's already established and has these other brands and has been able to prove itself for an established traditional news operation like Scripps to come in and buy that and then work it into its already existing system, I think is going to be could possibly be a win-win for both of them.
I'm curious, though, because Newsy's main idea is not to create original reporting, but to go out and take, you know, fair use snippets of media coverage from others on controversial or interesting or entertaining news, and then just adding sort of an analysis layer on top of that. Well, that works great for a national audience, but what is it that Scripps is interested in terms of the Newsy model in expanding that to local video for local television station websites? I'm not quite sure yet how that model translates.
Yeah, that's going to be the interesting part to see how they integrate that into their local operations, because they have a lot, as Mike said, they have a lot of local television stations and they still have some newspapers. So how that model fits into that locally is going to be interesting. It's going to be also be interesting to see whether or not any of the local material, the local content from the Scripps, from what Scripps owns right now, whether or not that's going to be integrated into Newsy to make it more of a, I would say, bring more of a hometown flavor to what's been a national operation.
Now, Mike, you even said yourself, this is all still very fresh. Right. We're just a few more than 48 hours since the announcement. But what changes might be in the works or might somebody expect to see either for some of our students who are working at Newsy or how the product might evolve?
I mean, I don't think we really know. I mean, so far they've been very careful to say that Jim Spencer is going to continue on for at least a few years, that they're going to remain in Columbia, Missouri, that they're going to continue that business model of using students as well as paid professional labor. So I don't really know what's going to be different. I will say this much, though, that Scripps is probably not going to just sort of take the Newsy model and keep it exactly the way it is. They are a very innovative company lately. I mean, they have some strong social media chops online. They've done a lot of experimentation. I noticed that they announced, I think last week, that their station, their TV station in Cincinnati is going to go behind a paywall, mm-hmm. something the TV stations don't do. So I imagine there are going to be some changes. I suspect changes for the good.
Okay, well, we should also mention before we move on to another topic that the Reynolds Journalism Institute, the University of Missouri, has also been an investor in Newsy since its move to Columbia. So.
And so the university and, in fact, RJI, where we're recording this program, mm-hmm. will get some cash as a result of that sale.
Right, along with some other investors here in the Columbia market. I think Ready was one of the investors. So there, it's not just going to be the university and RJI that's going to see a windfall from this, but there are also going to be some local investors who took a chance when Jim Spencer brought it here, who are also going to see some benefit from this.
So journalism aside, what could this mean? What does this signal for Columbia's entrepreneurial community?
If Newsy sticks around, as Scripps has said they will in Columbia, I think it's nothing but good. I mean, Jim Spencer and his team have been very active in the entrepreneurial community in terms of their support here because of the support they received from that community when they needed it. Newsy is doing some very innovative things that other startups in this market can, you know, learn from. So it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's one of this is going to be one of the public relations gems for local investment into bringing in small companies and maybe some medium sized companies to show that, hey, we can here in this community help a startup, help a fledgling company to grow to the point where they can be looked at by a national brand.
Okay, well, last Thursday, President Obama sat down for a town hall interview with MSNBC's Chris Matthews at American University in D.C. They talked about healthcare, NSA surveillance, Obama's relationship with his cabinet. He was asked and even managed to dodge a question about who he'd pick in 2016, Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton. But he did have some sharp criticism for the media.
The American people are good and they are decent. And yes, sometimes we get very divided, partly because our politics and our media specifically tries to divide them and splinter them. But, you know, we got so much stuff going for us that as long as any president stays close to the people, I think they're going to do all right.
So let me ask you, is it a fair criticism to make?
Oh, on the surface, sure. The media are probably as much to blame as anybody else, including the president, including Congress, including our, you know, political culture. It's kind of ironic that he's appearing on MSNBC, mm-hmm. one of those media outlets that tries to divide us between liberal and conservative. But, you know, presidents also, especially if there's a second term president, everybody's talking about him being lame duck president already. They sometimes look to paint history in the most flattering way they can and look for others to deflect the blame to.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where you have a, as Mike mentioned, a lame duck president who is thinking about what is his legacy going to be. And to go on MSNBC, which has been a staunch supporter of his, to actually talk about these issues and to basically say, look, the media has played a role in how I have been perceived and how it will be perceived in the future. That's standard operating procedure for a second-term president.
So at one point, Howard Kurtz, who's the host of Media Buzz on Fox News Channel, called this a softball interview, obviously an insult in a play on Hardball, Chris Matthews' program. Did Chris Matthews let the president slide?
Yes, and in fact, I think Howard Kurtz at one point said it was more like wiffle ball than softball. But if you go on our blog, Amy, mm-hmm. you have a nice link to a piece from the Washington Examiner, and all it did was listed essentially verbatim the 13 questions that Chris Matthews asked. First of all, some of those questions are fairly incoherent.
And they were rambling.
And second of all, yeah, they were softball questions, as you would expect. And I mean, I wouldn't want somebody doing a word-for-word transcription of an interview I conducted either, but I must say, I mean, it was pretty lame.
Well, I mean, I think people would have expected that from Chris Matthews because, like I said, he is a supporter of the president. And there was a clear message that was being sent there. Here's an opportunity for the president of the United States, who's been under severe criticism because of the healthcare rollout, mm-hmm. The Iran situation and that sort of thing, to be able to come on to a program that he knows he's going to get good play. And be able to basically spell it out. And Chris Matthews threw him some questions, which, you know, had he been on Fox or say had he been with the New York Times or maybe even the Wall Street Journal or something like that, though a lot of those questions would not have been asked. So they would have been much more in-depth and much more harsher.
And, of course, he was in front of a friendly audience of students at American University. I'd like him to do maybe a few more news conferences. That would probably be more useful with journalists in a room asking him questions.
The plural there yes. being key.
What's going to be really interesting is about a year from now, you're going to start seeing the president come out, as most second-term presidents do, and have a series of interviews that sort of set up the legacy. And that's where you're going to get a lot of questions about not only the good things that – been perceived of his presidency, but also some of the not so good things that are going to come out. So about a year from now is when you're going to start really seeing that ramp up. And this interview is going to be forgotten by that point.
Okay. Well, President Obama and Mrs. Obama, along with former Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Carter, traveled to South Africa to attend Nelson Mandela's public memorial service. Obama was among those to deliver a eulogy, giving a speech some were even calling among his best ever. But it wasn't the speech people were focusing on as the day went on. It was a gesture right before. Let's watch as it aired on CNN.
Now, there have been a lot of questions raised about security here, and before I came on, we were walking around and talking to security officials.
He's shaking hands with Raul
right,
Castro.
As Christian points out, President Obama just shook hands with Raul Castro from Cuba.
You could hear the surprise in anchors Chris Cuomo and Christian Amanpour's voices as Obama reached out to shake Castro's hand. Amanpour said she viewed this as an act of humanity, that he was kind of following the teachings of Mandela at a memorial service. You don't just walk by someone. How did you see this?
I would agree with that. I mean, you know, if you're going down the line, you just can't ignore someone. And I know political protocol would probably dictate that he does that. Mm-hmm. But you're at the memorial service for a legend, for Nelson Mandela, who not only embraced Cuba and Libya, but he also at certain times embraced the United States and some of its allies who were against Cuba and Libya. So, I mean, it wouldn't have been appropriate for him to just walk by and ignore Castro.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think maybe we make a little too much of it because we were looking for any kind of news other than the sort of the honorifics that you're going to get, or, you know, the canonizing of a great man at his funeral. So we were looking for a story. Maybe there was a story there. Is it having any lasting impact? I don't know. I think the Obama administration would like to thaw relationships with Cuba a little bit before he leaves office. And if that happens, that's probably a good thing.
So looking at some of the coverage we've seen in the last week since Mandela's death, Mike, you had pointed out to me a piece from NPR. There was a similar one in the Washington Post that really outlined that complicated relationship that Mandela had with the U.S. government over the course of decades.
Yeah, and I thought those were really useful pieces, those historical pieces, because they showed how complex the relationship was. I mean, we can think back to our own history here at Mizzou when we had the shantytown protests against apartheid, and we can remember a time when the U.S. government was was actually against some of the efforts to try to end apartheid. So I think it's good to put that historical context there. It doesn't do anything to diminish, you know, what Mandela, you know, accomplished, or what our presidents and others said about him. That context was really useful.
And I think it's very useful for us to go back and look at the fact that a lot of what Nelson Mandela was fighting against were some of the same things that our ancestors were fighting against. I mean, you talk about the separation of races. You talk about the American apartheid of Jim Crow. I mean, there was a lot of those things. So a lot of the teachings that Mandela followed were also the teachings that King followed and others followed. So, I mean, there's a connection there in the way in which that story is told. And I think what Mike was talking about in terms of the context is very important for Americans to understand as they look at the legacy of Nelson Mandela.
I thought too, Amy, one other story I really appreciated I saw from a couple of news organizations, and that was focusing on the fact that although President Obama got, you know, a lot of applause from the people in that stadium at the memorial service, there were some stories that focused on the fact that even though there was an expectation at the beginning of the president's term that he might change the conversation about the U.S. and African relationships, that really didn't happen. That, in fact, he'd only been there one time since his presidency, and that was, what, last year when he went to Robben Island, I think it was. And there really hasn't been a lot of focus in the U.S. government, at least that the media have reported on, toward African relations at a time when China is coming in there and is very aggressive. So that's a good story to know about, too.
Okay, well, we've talked a little bit about the media's love affair with Pope Francis. Today, Time magazine named him the 2013 Person of the Year. Did this come as a surprise to either one of you guys?
No. I mean, especially when you framed it as, well, it was between him and Miley Cyrus. I mean, thank goodness the Pope got it. But, right. You know, I mean, I do think that Time's whole Person of the Year is a focus on how the great person, the great man or great woman can affect history. And that's certainly a philosophy that Time tries to espouse. So sure, I don't know that the Pope in and of himself is causing a great deal of change, but he is that kind of hero figure that the media likes to focus on. I mean, think about it. The first non-European pope, he's a reformer. He's in favor of social justice and economic justice. He uses the media really well. Lots of things we said about President Obama when he was first elected. So why would Time pick him? Lots of good reasons and lots of historical precedent for doing
that. And I think part of it, too, is that you have a pope now who's trying to move past the stories that have been out there about the sex abuse and about the corruption within the church and that sort of thing. And he's addressed those things, but he's also trying to move past it. And I think the media itself has sort of going like, okay, how many more of these stories can we tell? And now we have a pope who's moving past that. So I'm not really surprised that Pope Francis was picked.
And frankly, I think some of the parallels between the media's coverage of the early Obama and coverage of this pope in his early months is kind of striking. I mean, now the media have kind of, you know, lost interest in Obama as being able to be the hope and change person that's going to bring us all together. But, you know, the president did have, you know, an elected Congress, mm-hmm. and the voters to deal with, whereas the pope, of course, he has opposition, but the pope pretty much speaks for the Catholic Church, at least officially. So there's a lot of room to report on the pope's ideas without necessarily having to bring up the constant drumbeat of criticism that the president's getting from Congress.
And I think the other issue here, especially with Pope Francis, is that he's willing to go against convention when it comes to the Roman Catholic Church, both within what's going on in Rome, but also as it relates to the Americas, and because he's not a European pope.
But he's going against convention in terms of the way Catholic teaching is talked about, right. is portrayed.
Right.
He's not really going against Catholic teaching on abortion, on policy,
right.
on
exactly.
abortion
sticking
or
with
women.
Doctrine
in the,
as yeah, he's sticking doctrine with is. Doctrine, but the right. way in which he talks about it.
Right.
And the way in which he deals with it is much different than what we've seen right. In the past pope.
Okay. Well, the number two, so the actual runner-up was Edward Snowden. Miley Cyrus was a little bit further down the list. But for shock value, it's always better to say the pope beats out right. Miley Cyrus. This weekend marks the one-year anniversary of the shooting massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. On December 14th of last year, Adam Lanza fatally shot 20 students and 6 staff members there, also killing his mother and himself. The town's first selectman, which is a role kind of like mayor, said it isn't planning to hold any public memorials and has asked the national media to stay away and give residents quiet time and privacy to grieve. Brian Kuntz, Metro editor of the Hearst, Connecticut newspapers, appeared on CNN's Reliable Sources. He said he hopes the national media respects the request. His paper is marking the anniversary by printing diary entries this week written by the loved ones of those killed.
You know, approaching it this way, trying to find some kind of, you know, meaningful insight mm-hmm. outside the confines of just, you know, doing this packed journalism mentality, I think for us certainly is the way to go. I mean, mm-hmm. we don't, you know, take any kind of pleasure in people's misfortunes and this tremendous heartache that people have experienced in Sandy Hook. However, what we do take pride in is the job that we've done. And I think that we've been very careful to report with clarity, with accuracy, with honesty, and perhaps most of all, compassion.
So we got our first taste of how the media was going to handle this last week when the 911 tapes were released. Were you surprised by who decided to air them, run transcripts, who didn't?
No, I'm not surprised, because I think what the media did in terms of the 911 tapes was to actually take a look at it and see was there anything there that warranted needing to be made public. I mean, was there slow response on the part of law enforcement officials? Were there slow response on the part of emergency medical officials? And they didn't see any of that. So they decided to err on the side of caution. And I do think that in these instances in which you have this kind of tragedy, especially involving children, that the media has been very smart to sort of not play it up very, very, very big in terms of anniversaries and that sort of thing.
I thought the media, the ones at least that we saw through our lens here of being observing from a distance, they did a very ethically responsible job of dealing with those tapes, even when they came to different conclusions about what to do with them. But I think it's important to say that the media did a good job of deciding how to respond to this. It's wrong for the government or for politicians to try to decide for us whether we should have access to information like those 911 tapes. I mean, there was nothing wrong. The 911 operator, emergency dispatch, all those folks apparently responded correctly. But what if something hadn't gone right? We're not supposed to have access to those tapes to be able to show our audience what went wrong?
Yeah, I think those, you know, when you start having those kinds of laws and regulations that limit what the media can and can't access in terms of public information, I think you're running into some problems, because in this instance, yes, I can understand limiting it. But
it's the situation when something does go
exactly,
wrong, we don't
exactly.
have access.
We don't have access, and then you don't have that outside source that's looking at what are our government officials doing or not doing in situations where they are the ones who are held responsible for showing up in terms of safety, in terms of providing medical assistance, in terms of providing law enforcement. So I just think that, you know, those kinds of laws are very dangerous.
And these rules are often written too broadly, you know, these new laws. I mean, I think, for example, if there is a blanket, you know, prohibition against using police photographs or 911 tapes of a massacre like this where children are involved, well, you know, imagine a situation where that is applied to a situation like the woman, the school employee in Atlanta, Antoinette mm-hmm. Tough.
Right.
I mean, she was a hero in talking down a shooter who came into a school and playing those tapes, as CNN and other news organizations.
That tape was the story.
That was fantastic, yeah. uplifting kind of story.
And it's also educational, because yeah. now others can see, okay, here's how you can handle a situation like this. But if that tape wasn't made available, right. then people wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about the anniversary story in general. Is there a reason to cover the first anniversary, the second anniversary, the fifth, the tenth? Or is it easy journalism to look at a calendar and know that we can find a natural story idea because this happened 7 years ago today?
Well, if they're going to do the story, I would prefer that they do an anniversary story that talks about what hasn't happened since Newtown in terms of legislation involving guns. And I'm not advocating on the part of being, you know, pro-gun rights or anti-gun rights. I'm just talking about what has happened in terms of that, because it's not just that shooting. It's Aurora, Colorado. It's going all the way back to Columbine. What has happened? I mean, if you can look at what happened in Newtown in the context of where are we when it comes to talking about access to guns and also access to mental health and mental health legislation, then that's, I think, is probably the best way to cover this anniversary.
Yeah, I agree with Ernest. And frankly, I'm one of those people who really likes anniversary stories. I agree they can be oversimplified. But one of the things that news organizations don't tend to do as a rule is do a good job of providing historical context, revisiting stories that were important once upon a time and finding out what's happened next. I like them. I've got to say, though, that in doing the anniversary stories this year, if the folks there in Newtown really believe the national media are just going to not cross the boundaries of Newtown and come in, no. I mean, they have to have visuals to tell that story.
Yeah, there'll be some who won't, but I would say that most of the ones who were there when the shooting happened will probably be there for the anniversary.
So, quickly, I need to ask, did either one of you read the big piece in Monday's New York Times about homelessness in the city? You may have first seen it on the Las Vegas Sun website. That's right, the New York Times managed to scoop itself. Sunday evening, the Times political editor tweeted, bragging that there would be a groundbreaking story coming that was unusual and would really make you think. She came back several more times on Twitter saying how excited she was for the story, but that publication was being delayed until after Homeland on Showtime Sunday night. Cue the Las Vegas Sun. Sometime around 8 p.m. Eastern, it somehow found its way from the New York Times wire, of which the Sun is a subscriber, onto the Sun website. BuzzFeed political reporter Andrew Kaczynski found the link and tweeted. Sun editors removed the story and issued an apology, blaming the mishap on a new automated feed system that automatically pushed the story online. So, who do you believe? Human error, computer error?
I would believe computer error. I mean, if you automatically have it set up to do that and it's going to happen at a certain time, the computer doesn't know. So, I mean, and luckily someone was there to catch it, but not until after it had gotten out. And I did read the story, and it is a very good and a very powerful story. And I do recommend that our listeners and our viewers do take a look at it, because it really does point out the problems of homelessness in a way that I think very few other stories have done. But I don't think that there's a one human person or several human people that we can blame for the Las Vegas Sun scooping the New York Times on one of its own stories.
It was probably technical error. I didn't read the story yet, but I must say I don't think this does any harm really to the New York Times except a bit of embarrassment. In fact, it probably provides some additional promotion for people to go and read what is apparently a very useful and important story.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us today, watching and listening with us. There's more background for all of today's topics on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there. Send us an email. Our address is views@kbia.org. Many thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing our show and to KBIA's Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'll be taking a few weeks off, but you'll want to be sure to listen in next week as Mike, Ernest, and Jim Flink will be with you for another edition of Views of the News.